Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed.
Weekend Nigeria on the Spirit of Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed and positive Nigerian energy. It's that time of the day when we have a guest on the, well, not in the studio, on the studio, because they are from the air, you know, that kind of something. All right, so we're talking to Dr. Bodea Keton. He is a pediatric psychiatrist. So we shall read his bio and then introduce him and then get straight on with our questioning. Dr. Bodea Keton is a child and adolescent psychiatrist. He is a medical director of the RBC Child and Youth Mental Health Inpatient Program, as well as the pediatric psychiatry ER at McMaster Children's Hospital. Dr. Keton is an assistant professor of psychiatry at McMaster University and deputy chief of the Division of Child Psychiatry at Hamilton Health Sciences. His interest in the emergency acute care pediatric psychiatry, and he has won teaching awards for his work with students and residents. A graduate of the University of Jos Medical School. That's my school, you know. I went to Unijos, so, you know, I know some famous people. Let me just go back. A graduate of the University of Jos Medical School, he went on to complete his psychiatry residency training at the University of Maryland and then later a two-year fellowship at the Shepherd Pratt. You know that. You see, I say I'm famous. I have to be serious, really. At the Shepherd Pratt University of Maryland program. Since moving back to Canada in 2008, his leadership roles at McMaster informed a decision to pursue formal management training, and he completed a dual MBA program with Cornell University and Queen's University in 2015. This guy is hot. He's passionate about developing and supporting others through mentorship and by sharing stories and experiences of his life. He has been invited to speak about his work, his interest, and his life, and has given keynote addresses at various... Did you just send me a message? Excuse me, I beg your pardon. And he has been invited to speak about his work, his interest, and his life, and has given keynote addresses at various events covering a wide range of topics. Buddy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're most welcome. And thank you for, you know, whenever I'm speaking to any of you in the overseas, especially in the US of A, you would understand how grateful I am that you would actually wake up so early in the morning and do this. It truly is, I'm truly, truly grateful.
It's my pleasure.
Great. Thank you for inviting me again. Okay, so tell us, why pediatric psychiatry?
Why not?
Well, that's a good answer, but...
Well, here's the thing. Having been raised in Nigeria, where we are still in the early stages of our development and appreciation for the world of psychiatry, it wasn't something that I even knew existed. I knew that psychiatry existed, but not pediatric psychiatry. Mm. I knew that I liked working with children, and so it was just... kind of pursuing both of those interests that led me to pick the subspecialty. When I came to North America in 1999 and I started preparing for my board exams, it was clear that I was fascinated by mental health. And so discovering that there was a field of mental health that also aligned with my interest in working with children, it was a perfect fit.
Right.
I'm fascinated by the brain. I'm fascinated by the capacity for the brain to learn, to develop, to grow, and how it solves problems. So that was just a kind of a scientific interest I had growing up. And then being able to merge that with a developing brain was just a perfect alignment.
Wow. You know, I'm thinking back and I'm thinking, okay, 1999. You know, I'm trying to correlate it with when I left university, which was probably about the same time you left, maybe a year or so later. And I'm thinking... how were you so, but then again, you read medicine, so you know all the, you have all the expo. Because I'm just thinking mental health, I'm not even sure it was in my purview in 1999. Yeah, because I'm thinking, go ahead, please.
I'll tell you a story.
Yes.
I graduated in 1996, and I did my internship, or what we call housemanship in Nigeria,
yes,
at a hospital in Lagos. And I had the privilege of working with a St. Nicholas Hospital.
Okay.
And we had a consultant psychiatrist who would come and see are patients who have mental health difficulties. And yes. It was fascinating to me what he did. Fascinating to me. But again, it was niche. You're absolutely right. It wasn't something that people talked about. We weren't even allowed to go into the rooms when he did his assessments.
Wow.
That was how almost cloak and dagger it was then. But I was fascinated by it even then.
So how were you supposed to learn if... How were you supposed to learn on the job if you weren't even allowed in the room?
Well, so at St. Nicholas, psychiatry was not then one of our core...
Okay. So it was kind of like outsourced.
So, yes, it was outsourced. The person was not a full member of staff. We had OBGYN, we had pediatrics, we had internal medicine, we had pediatric surgery.
Yes,
but not psychiatry. So we just have a consultant come in and do his, what I called magic then, and then leave.
Right. Okay. I'm going to jump, because when you talked about the brain now and how fascinated you were, I kind of saw the capacity that you have, because I'm looking at, reading your bio and seeing that you did a double MBA at the same time. I mean, yes, we know you're fascinated with the brain. Obviously, your brain could take it because you completed both. I mean, why did you need to do a double MBA?
Because it was there. and I hate to sound, pithy, but the world of business schools now is very competitive. And I saw an opportunity to get both an Ivy League degree. And Queen's University in Canada is a premier program for the finance industry.
Okay.
So they have very strong economics degrees, very strong finance degrees, and their MBA is also ranked as one of the best in the country, if not the best in the country. So it just seemed like a golden opportunity to kill two birds with one stone.
Right.
It was a 17-month program, and here's the thing. It was probably more grueling than medical school.
I can imagine.
Yeah,
I mean, you didn't only choose one. You didn't choose the best in the world. You decided to add another one onto it. I mean, what? Hello? But you're the better for it, obviously.
Now.
Yes. Overachiever.
I was well trained.
Well trained. I like that. I really like that. So this best university, this is just to boost my own ego here, is the one that is that has the slash Pratt, Abby.
Oh, so Shepherd, I've been very fortunate, and I think that it's easy for me to take credit for this. But people have mentored me, people have led me, people have guided me, and people have given me opportunities. Shepherd Pratt and the University of Maryland Hospital Medical Center were opportunities I had. I interviewed, the program directors saw me fit to be a part of the organization, and I was accepted at both places. So I'm tempted to take credit, but the honest person in me would say that people just saw opportunities and they granted me those opportunities and I ran with them.
Okay, that's truly something that is a gift that a lot of people don't have. Seeing the opportunities in front of them and grabbing them and running with them and, being better at what they do. So let's come to what you do for a living on a day-to-day basis. And I'm going to ask a question that most mothers would probably ask. How do you feel when you, and I mean, this is, and I know you have feelings, even though you are medically wired. Yes. How do you feel when you have, even though this is what you do, when you have a young child brought to you and you have to decipher with this child where, how they got to where they are and why they are where they are?
So, first of all, I think to get context,
yes.
Training to be a child psychiatrist takes a long time.
Okay.
In Canada here, to be a general psychiatrist, it takes 5 years. To be a child psychiatrist, it takes an extra 2 years. And that's 7 years after completing medical school, which you complete medical school after you've completed an undergraduate degree.
Lord have mercy.
So that's 4 years of undergraduate, 4 years of medical school, 5 years of psychiatry, and 2 years of child psychiatry.
Wow.
So it's a lifetime of honing a set of skills to learn a field. And so you don't lose your humanity as a result of that. You just become primed to understand that what you're doing is not simply hanging out with a young person who has a mental health difficulty. You're looking at it very surgically and kind of pardon the use of another medical field as a way to communicate what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
So the point is, you can still, I mean, I'm a parent, and at home, I don't play child psychiatrist. I'm a dad. If my child is sad, if my child is depressed, I'll be just as hurt and just as impacted as any other parent. However, when I go to work, I have my game on, I have my game face on, and so I'm looking at that in a way that perhaps is a little more removed, but much more informed by the years of training.
Okay. So let's be a bit more specific now. Of course, the situations you are in a country where, or in a space. Let me use space where things are hardly ever swept under the carpet. Things are not attributed to our village people or my neighbor who does not like me or the devil, you know. But you know that's how we are, you know. I mean, so we refuse to see the signs. I will give you an example. A few weeks ago, I think somebody came to see me and she said to me, oh, she was just coming from a friend's place that they lost their teenage son. And I was like, oh, what happened to the child? And she said, the child committed suicide. I said, I'm sorry. This is in Lagos, Nigeria. So, of course, I was like, what do you mean? She said the sad thing was the boy told his mom that he wanted to commit suicide. She reported to his dad. His dad beat the living daylights out of him. The mom went back and said, oh, she didn't think that what his dad did was good, you know, so she begged him and something. And the boy still took his life. So while I understand the frustration of the father, as in my father would probably have done the same thing. Do you understand? But I'm thinking, when a child comes to you who you have raised by yourself, you haven't outsourced his raising, and says something like this, how does it not trigger for us that there's something deeper going on? How do we think a beating is going to get it out?
Such a sad story. I mean, it's a sad story. And every child who takes his or her own life is a sad story. And it happens across the world. I think the familiarity with the Nigerian ethos and how we ascribe meaning to things based on our religious, our cultural, and our societal environment and upbringing does put us at a disadvantage.
Yes.
I think what I will say and what I can celebrate is that people are beginning to pay attention a little bit. It's not where it needs to be, but it's much better than it was. And so I have many of these conversations. I have patients of mine who are Nigerians. I have to have conversations with their parents. Sometimes their parents are here in Canada. Sometimes their parents are in Nigeria. When I speak with them, there's a familiarity that they have when they speak with me, and they're relieved to know that the person who's taking care of their child is a Nigerian. Mm. And then they revert back to that, you know, the children get soft when they go to Canada, and that incenses me. Because many times, at least in for context, I've had children who, or adolescents who I've treated, who had symptoms back in Nigeria. They probably just migrated to Canada, and they've been in Canada for about 2 years or a year, and then they have symptoms, and then they're suicidal or something else is going on. And then you date back to their symptoms, and they used to engage in self-injury by cutting or hurting themselves. Years when they were in Nigeria. And the parents are completely oblivious to it. And they would say that they have to go for deliverance, they have to go for this, and they have to go for that. But I do consider myself in a privileged position to be able to be bilingual in some way. So I can speak to the cultural nuance of being a Nigerian, and I can speak to the science of what needs to be done. And so although it's a small role I play, I mean, I'm one physician in a world of billions, I do think that for every person that I meet who I can translate what the science says to, I hope that they continue to share that information with others and they enlighten others. And I know that there are people in Nigeria who are doing a great job of trying to chip away at the resistance, which is what I'll call it, to recognizing that mental health is just as legitimate as our other physical health symptoms.
Yes.
So it's a big task, but it's something that a lot of people are doing in Nigeria. We all have a small role to play, but it starts with educating. I don't think that these parents are bad parents. I think they love their children. I think they love their children in a language that is familiar to them.
There you go.
Our parents loved us. They loved us in a very unique way. We can critique what they did, but we know that they loved us.
Yes, for sure. Oh, wow. So what would... And I know that some of these questions are going to come across as simplistic, but what would cause a 12-year-old, for instance, to pick up a sharp object and cut themselves? Where do they have to be to get there?
Well, it's not that far to imagine it, right? So we all...
He's far from you. I'm sorry. I'm almost 50 and he's far from me. I'm thinking picking up a sharp object.
Let me put it in context.
Please. Right?
We all cope in different ways.
True.
We all cope in different ways. If I feel exhausted, I go for a run. 5K, 10K, you feel better. That works for me.
You go for a run when you're exhausted?
Yeah.
Wow.
Just when you're mentally exhausted, not physically exhausted.
Okay, okay.
Like when you just feel like you need to clear your head,
okay.
Right?
Okay, I get that.
Now, at my age, I've learned a variety of coping skills and I've figured out what works for me. When I'm 12, I haven't learned almost 50 years of coping skills.
True.
So I don't have a lot of coping skills and I try to find the one that works for me. Now, for many people, and I think it's important to make the distinction here, having suicidal thoughts is very different from having an urge to harm yourself.
Right.
The urge to harm yourself, the urge to inflict pain on oneself, it's kind of like when you bite your lip or when you clench your fist. You're trying to create some kind of input that gives you grounding.
Yes.
For some people, their threshold is higher and so they engage in cutting or inflicting pain in some capacity. So it's a way of coping. Coping with stress, coping with distress, coping with adversity. It is a maladaptive or a, I don't want to use a pejorative term like bad or something, but it's an unhealthy way of coping, but it is a way of coping nonetheless. So when a 12-year-old takes a knife to cut themselves, they're not trying to damage something. They're trying to cope.
Right.
And that is what is important for people to appreciate, that it isn't, it is really just their way of coping. And the way we help them is we recognize that there must be something extraordinarily painful that they're experiencing for which they are trying to manage. That is how they are trying to manage.
You know, that is like a light bulb going off in my brain. And I'm thinking to the number of times where I've heard even 7-year-olds tell me that they're stressed. And I have said to them in response that, stressed? You're 7. What can you be stressed about? And while I may take the conversation further, I never looked at it from this point that you have just raised, which is they're trying to cope with something, and something is because they don't have coping mechanisms like we do. They just take that word, and that word says what it is they are going through. And if we do not probe, we do not understand where they are.
Correct.
Wow.
And I want to piggyback off of that. The probing piece is so important, and here is why. We as parents tend to be problem solvers. Many times these kids want to be heard. They don't want necessarily to have the problem solved. So it's important to ask the questions from a place of curiosity, not a solution-driven place. Sometimes the kids just want to be heard. They just want you to understand their problem,
true,
not necessarily solve their problem.
True.
And so when you go into problem-solving mode and you think you've done something, the child is still there thinking, I didn't want this solved because I'm going to have a similar problem tomorrow and I still don't know how to cope with it. Yeah.
Wow. So you must have Pandora's box open for you every single day with every different every child that you speak to.
Well, the benefit of science is that science works in aggregates, right? So okay. we look at patterns. So okay. although each individual is unique, we practice based on established guidelines. No different than surgery. Every patient who comes to get an appendectomy is different. But appendectomies are done based on certain guidelines. So okay. yes, each child is unique. Each child has its own story. However, the science of it is based on guidelines. And the guidelines are based on a general population that has been studied to have a certain number of kind of symptoms and signs that align in one category. And then you can offer a certain intervention based on what we see in that pattern.
What you see in that pattern. Okay. Yeah. So what are the signs? Are there any signs that you can give us that we should look out for and we shouldn't be in a rush to dismiss and not rely on our own growing up and experiences? Because I think that's what we do. Yeah. We just draw a parallel. We're like, you know what? When I was growing up, I was this age and this happened to me and this is how it was dealt with. So the same thing can apply to you.
You know, you've hit so many things there. One is that somehow, because we survived our childhood, it was good for us. And so because we are now in our 50s, everything that happened to us was good. And so it's okay for our child or our ward to have gone to go through it, because somehow it made us who we are. I would argue that we survived in spite of all of those experiences, not because of those experiences.
Okay.
That's one. The other thing is, as much as I consider myself a pediatric mental health expert, every time I meet with a parent, I tell them, you are the expert of your child.
True.
You bore them. You have raised them. I am simply coming in here to provide perspective and provide some suggestions. But in terms of knowing your child, you are the expert. And here's what that means. What you're looking for, so as experts, we consider dysfunction as our threshold. And what I mean by that is anybody can have a headache. Anybody can have backache. You go to work, you have backache. I'm like, oh, sorry, eh? And I move on. If you have backache or a headache that makes it impossible for you to work, then you have a disorder. Then you have dysfunction. So the presence of symptoms alone is not really significant. It is the capacity for that symptom to impact your functioning. That is when there's a problem. And now taking that to your question around when will a parent be considered, you know your child. When the child deviates from the pattern that you've already established as familiar to that child, then you have to start to worry. If they're not able to function, they're not able to go to school, they're not able to hang out with, they stop hanging out with friends, they start to isolate themselves. If this was not an established pattern before, those are the red flags. Those are the times when you want to lean in and ask the question, my dear, things seem to have changed. Is there anything that you want to talk about? Those kinds of questions are probing non-judgmental questions that would perhaps open the door into a conversation about what the child is going through.
So I'm going to give you two variables now based on what you've just said. If the parent by some chance, and I know that that happens a lot, misses those signs, and by the time they get to you, barring suicide, are the children ever at a point of no return? Or can they be nursed back?
So I work with children because I am an eternal optimist and I never want to grow old.
Okay.
And the reason I do those, the reason those two things are important to me is that I believe that I can always make a difference. Otherwise, I would just pack up my stethoscope and walk away. So there is no such thing as somebody who has reached a point of no return.
Okay.
Because at the end of the day, there is no such thing as the perfect child.
True.
Every person wants to be a member of the community, a contributing member of the community, and they want to not only experience love, but they also want to show love. That is the threshold for wellness. at the end of the day, all the accolades we get, all the degrees, all those things, those are just ephemeral. You want to be able to show love and experience love. And I think as far as that is concerned, that is a goal that everybody can achieve.
Very true. Okay, so, sorry, my head is actually bursting because I'm thinking, oh, Lord God Almighty. I mean, this is heavy, and it's not happening to adults. Yeah. It's happening to children. Okay, so the thought just came back. So I'm thinking, from the point of view of a parent who leaves home at 5, doesn't get home till, if they're lucky, 9. They've provided the school, they've provided the snacks, they've provided the technological equipment that the child will need, they've provided the help that will look after the child. They probably realistically do not see their children except maybe when they go to church together on Sunday. And by then, the parent's mind is already thinking, gosh, I have this meeting on Monday, I have this blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'm also going to borrow your sentence and say, I am not saying that this parent is bad. What I'm saying is, or what I'm asking is, how do we turn this around? How do we get us to see that, yes, we need to provide for our children physically, but we need more to provide a mental connection with our children, so that no matter where we are or whether we're there or not, they can feel that connection and at any point in time know that when they come to us, we'll open that door?
I think you've kind of answered the question. Because what I'm hearing is you're saying it's really about the quality of the experience, not the quantity,
yes,
of time you spend with the child. And so if you're not able to be with your child for 15 hours of the day because you have a demanding job that requires that you're physically present at a different place, there are many ways you can communicate. Our children are both adults now, but when they were younger, my wife would make their lunch boxes and put little post-it notes in them saying, I love you. So they would see that when they are at school. They would open their lunch box and see a note from mommy saying, I love you, or saying a prayer to them. Those were little ways that she communicated to them, and she stayed connected to them, even though she was not physically present. There are many ways that you can ensure that the time you spend with the children is quality time. So when you're going to church on Sunday, that's not quality time. You're going to perform a task.
Yes.
You're not playing a board game. You're not doing something that is simply what the child wants to do. No child is clamoring, let's go to church, let's go to church, let's go to church on Sunday. But if that is the only time they get to spend with their parents, they're going to celebrate it, and then you're going to be misinformed, thinking that, yes, they enjoy going to church. No, they enjoy spending time with you. Oh. And so I think it's important to recognize that this is about the quality of the experience of spending time with your child, not the quantity of time you spend with your child. So a lot of people have guilt about how much time they spend with their children, but they forget that the value of that connection is how good that time is.
I agree with that, because if I write off the experiences that I've had with my nephew, and when I hear him speak about his parents, it is obvious from the first word out of his mouth that there is a mental connection, there's a love connection. He knows that they're his backbone, his support, and he can speak to them about anything and everything. And for me, that is priceless. Even if he's a bit worried about some of the things he wants to speak about, he knows that he can still go back, irrespective of what the outcome will be, and still have a conversation with his parents. And they will arrive at some sort of jaw, you know. And that for me, I hate to use the word judgmental, but sometimes I am judgmental about parents. But then again, there's so many variables. So let me be kind. Let me be kind. Because it's true, there's so many variables. Looking on the outside doesn't mean that I know what's going on the inside.
True.
how do we... I have a lot of how do we questions. It's just... I mean, I guess, like you said, there is a good thing out of this, because it's becoming more recognizable. People are understanding that while I know my child, I cannot deal with this on my own. So I need to have somebody who will look at it from the outside in and show me a perspective that I don't have. Now, I hear a lot in groups. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I hear a lot in groups where I am in, and I hear things like the situation that our children have found themselves in, or these times that our children have found themselves in, or, you know, it's social media that is causing this. And my instant reaction is, whatever situation, whatever social media, we provide it. If I decide that because my child has harassed me at the age of 10, that all their friends have a phone, and they have this particular phone, and I give that child the phone, and I give the child the password to the Wi-Fi, and I do not put checks in place for the child when they're on the internet, I cannot blame social media. I am the enabler. How do we not see that?
Well, you know, especially for our generation, social media caught us off guard. Like, yeah, I mean, we were in school where we'd have to go to, I think it was called Nitel, right?
Yes.
Make phone calls to our parents back home. It was an event. Going to make a phone call to your parent was an event. You took a cab to a place where you put a number, you gave it to a lady or a man, and they called the number and said, "Buddy." Before, that was how we called our parents, once every week or once every 2 weeks, depending on what you agreed to. So we are also watching this unfold. Unfortunately, our children, this is all they know. So I think we should be kinder to them, because we are the foreigners in this world. And so when we try to police it, I don't think we understand the context of it. I had a conversation with a patient's parent last week, and they were talking about an online communication platform called Discord. Now, Discord is for gamers. I don't know if there are gamers in the audience. Okay. Gamers, high-end gamers, communicate. It's almost like their WhatsApp platform.
Okay.
And so they just chat on it. But she hadn't heard about it, because she'd heard about Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. She hadn't heard about Discord. And so she said she was going to ban her child, and she pulled it from her child, and the child was suicidal. This is a child who has anxiety, who was socially isolated, and this was her way of communicating with anybody. So it wasn't, but she was worried, because she was like, well, there might be pedophiles in there. Yeah. And she had legitimate concerns. I think her fears were legitimate, because she did not understand the context, that Discord for her was the only way she communicated with anybody. And if she did not have Discord, she did not feel that there was any point in living.
Wow.
The bigger point here is, we do not understand social media the way the children do.
True.
I'm not endorsing social media. I'm not giving parenting advice. I'm simply saying that we have to be a little kinder in terms of all of these rules that we're making. And we have to recognize that that the ground is literally shifting from underneath us. And the children who are going to judge us are the ones that we're raising right now. The same way we've judged our parents, the same way we can criticize them and say that they beat us unnecessarily, or they were unnecessarily harsh to us, our children are going to judge us. And so I think everything should be in moderation. I don't believe that children should be on social media the entire day. But if anybody has had the experience of a pandemic before and they consider themselves experts, I would like to meet with them. We are all living in unprecedented times.
True.
And I don't think that the rules that we have applied before are relevant now.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should all be kind of that to ourselves. Maybe if you had this conversation a year and a half ago, I might have given different kind of advice or given a different perspective. But right now, I am just believing that everybody should just take a step back and just figure out, how do we get through this? This is not the tend to be policing social media and policing. We are all working online anyway. We are all on screen.
Tell me about it.
There are just so many things there that it's just, I just want to unpack the fact that one, we have to be kind to ourselves. Two, we have to recognize that this is a foreign thing that we are just learning about. And so we cannot consider ourselves the experts of it. And we are just as guilty of spending time on social media as our children are. So I think there's a hypocrisy there that I'm going to sidestep that a bit. But I think there is an expectation somehow that we understand this. We do not understand social media the way our children do. And they will judge us when they become the ones who are running the world.
Oh, I think I've gone soft in the head, you know, as I'm getting older, because you have just given me another perspective that now makes absolute sense at looking at through the eyes of love to parents who I think have lost it. But so now I understand. We are struggling with social media, and it's true. It's true. It's very true. Okay, so here's a thought that just occurred to me. So in terms of awareness, and I'm talking in terms of awareness for the children, by the children, so that they themselves, because I hear a lot of adults say, oh, you know, children are wicked or evil. And I'm like, hello, we were there once. We all did the same things. I mean, it transcends, it's not only children. I mean, you can see baby safe. The father is rubbing the baby or, you know, massaging the baby and stretches out his hand to touch the mother. And the baby smacks the father's hand. I said, so really, it's not like as if it's just for these children. How do we incorporate awareness for our children? And I know at the back of my head, I'm thinking to myself, the only way you can do this is if you talk about it. But how do we make sure that it also transcends home? Because also, and I'm not judging anyone by saying this, we have kind of, sometimes it seems like we've abdicated our roles and expect that the teachers in school and the Sunday school teachers in churches and the imams in mosques and in wherever it is that we send our children to will take full authority, forgetting, as you had earlier mentioned repeatedly, that we know our children best.
Yes.
How do we create this awareness for the children? Let's forget the adults. The adults will catch up.
It's funny. It's a really, really good question. And there are things that we teach our kids, and then there are things that we model for our kids.
Okay.
And you know what they remember?
What we model.
We model for them.
Yes.
Yes. Not what we say. The number of lectures, and I'm putting lectures in air quotes, that my parents gave me. Oh, if you do this, they will just talk, and you zone out after the first 10 seconds. You're not listening, you're just being polite and being respectful, and you're standing there. But the things that they do, the kindness that they show others, those things are lasting. So when, as parents, we model for our kids respect for people with mental health difficulties, respect and acknowledgement of people's differences, they remember that, and it becomes part of their language. It becomes part of their worldview. It doesn't matter how many times we talk about it. It matters what we do. And so that means, again, sadly, we have to look inward and say, what is it that we're saying and what is it that we're doing? I think if, as a parent, you meet with somebody who is struggling on the street, and instead of saying, mate, that we're here alone, which translates to, don't pay any mind to that crazy person. You can say, oh my goodness, I wish somebody would help that person. That person is struggling. That alone sends a message to a young person who is watching you that you have to be kind to others, regardless of their state in life, and especially their mental state.
That's a long tenor, but nothing is impossible. I'm going to, you know, just latch onto your optimism here and say that, you know, there's never an end of the line, so to speak. We are, and I'm not going to say that we're conditioned. I think we choose the path of least resistance, because overall we're dealing with so many things, and sometimes we ourselves, just like you have, as you have said, alluded to social media, we do not understand what's going on. We're just coasting.
Yeah.
So when it's time to sit, it's true. Now it's time to sit down, delve deeper. You're thinking, wah, me OT, I've not done myself. How do I want to now do you? Why that? And it's like, you know what? It's like the brain just freezes and you're like, okay, you know what? I'm going dancing. When I come back, you will still be here. We will pick up from here. You know, but the child will interpret that differently.
The child
will interpret it differently. And I think now I totally have an understanding of, I think, more of the adults and how we react than, and I understand the children also. I mean, their world is different. It's completely different from us. And if we do not have some sort of understanding of what it is their world is like, there's no way we can help them. There's no way
exactly,
we can help them.
Exactly. I mean, and that is why we have to keep asking the questions and not coming from a place of, I know. You know, our children here have actually schooled us. There are times when we tell them, if it was my time, I couldn't talk to my parents like that. But if it was my time, they're like, Daddy, it's not your time. Like, just get over that.
Can we move on, Daddy? I mean, can we just move on? How long ago were you my age?
Exactly. And it's so profound. I mean, and when they say it, they're like, Daddy, I'm not raising my voice. I'm simply making my case. And I'm like,
there was somebody we interviewed a while ago, and he said his younger daughter is in the musical industry, or in the music industry, I beg your pardon. And she came in with a friend of his, and they were talking to her dad. And then the guy looks at the dad and says, you're a goat. And the father said he almost fell off his chair. That's, which kind of insult? Yoruba, typical Yoruba man. That's, which kind of insult is this? That, you know, but he said for some reason, that he has no understanding of how he did not lose his top until that child left. And then he was going in the car with his daughter and was like, what kind of disrespect is that? And she said, oh, it's an acronym for something, something, something. In fact, he thought to himself,
greatest of all time.
Thank you. Because I forgot it. I was like, the first thing he thought to himself was, along where my show, where my yummy, that you, I didn't disgrace myself in front of my child, first and foremost. You know, he said it didn't even occur to him to say to the guy, I'm a goat. Is that an acronym for something, or what does that mean? He said he had gone into a full blow-up mode in his mind. It just didn't translate into physical, if not. I said, because I'm thinking, but it just shows how different our worlds are. And there is coming back from this, isn't there? There is. There has to be. How do we... And I know I've asked this question before. I'm sure I've asked it before. Because in my mind, itself, I'm about to ask you. I'm thinking I'm asking again. But truly, please re-emphasize for us again what we as parents need to do to help our children, who will in turn help us navigate this world that we have brought them into.
You know, I don't know that there is an all-encompassing answer. I think that it's a number of things. One is to recognize our own fallibility, to know that we do not have all the answers, to know that we are in a constant state of learning, to know that we are almost always going to fall short of our expectations. I think once we are kinder to ourselves, it's easier to have perspective on how difficult it must be for other people, and especially our children. It allows you to do some healthy perspective taking. So I think that's the first step. Recognizing, wait a minute, I don't know this thing, and I want to learn. And sometimes even modeling the learning experience with the child is so valuable because it makes them feel empowered, gives them agency. They recognize that, wait a minute, my mom or my dad did not know this, and they went to learn it. So it gives them the sense that, so there's a process here that, one, I'm not expected to know certain things, or I'm not expected to know all things,
right. But
I'm expected to be willing to learn things. That is a very, that's a significant cultural shift for us.
True.
I remember in medical school, I was training to know everything. And the first few things that I learned when I moved here was, no, you can look it up.
Imagine that. You don't need the information in your brain. Just look it up.
Ah, yeah, you can look it up.
Wow.
And so if we're kinder to ourselves and we give ourselves this platform where we're saying, I want to know more. So you can know more about topics you don't know enough about. You can know more about the child by asking the questions and just creating this learning environment where everybody feels like, you know what, we all want to be better. That is a very simple, doable step. True. The rest of it will fall in line. There's nothing that is happening to humanity now that hasn't happened to humanity before. True. I'm not as pessimistic about where things are going, but I do think that we probably have an opportunity here to try to move the needle a little further along, and especially for our children, we create a kinder world for them. But the only way we can create a kinder world is by doing it one person at a time. Be kinder to yourself.
Those are words that we should all just, you know, you let it be screensaver, put it everywhere you can see it. Be kinder to yourself. Because it's true, because when you look at yourself and you're thinking, we set ourselves on pedestals that are not, don't even have a solid foundation. And we just say, I'm standing strong. You know, and the thing is, the wind has blown it out of the place where it's standing. We're still like, no, I'm standing there, I'm still here. Meanwhile, there's nothing under you. Kai. Wow. Okay, so the last few minutes that I have, I'm going to turn inwards and I'm going to return personal to you. So what do you miss most about Nigeria? Do you miss anything about Nigeria?
Well, I'm glad you reframed the question. my uncle said to me one, this was many, many years ago. He's lived in North America since 1972.
Jesus.
He said, "But Nigeria is the one place you can get away with anything, and it feels good to know that you can." And he said, he said it obviously in jest. He was obviously being a bit, he was exaggerating.
Yes.
But he said it, and he said, it gives you a sense of freedom. And so that freedom makes you feel like, wow, I like it here. But then I corrected him, and I said, the problem is that freedom applies to everybody. So just as you feel free to do whatever you want to do, other people feel free to do whatever they want to do, and that could hurt you.
True.
So what do I miss most about Nigeria? I miss my friends. I miss the kind of relationship that Nigeria kind of harbors. Mm. I miss the spontaneity of, I'm in front of your house, so I'm coming in, as opposed to, are you free Saturday next week so I can pop in for about 20 minutes?
Jeez, man!
So I miss that. I miss the... I used to live on King George in... I can't remember this place.
Yes,
Onikan. Across from Ghana High.
Onikan, yes.
And I miss the fish that I used to have on Wednesday night. There was a fish place, fish pepper soup place. That was nice. I miss that. You have to understand that my entire family is in North America. So outside of my in-laws, I don't really miss family. All of my family is around me. So I feel blessed in that way. So there are a few specific things that I miss. I don't miss the sadness. I think that there's a lot of sadness. It's not that deep. I think if you ask two or three probing questions, you can get to a place of sadness for almost everybody.
True.
But I think that hurts me. And I miss, and I don't mean I miss this in a fond way. When I was in Nigeria last, I cried the day I was leaving.
Oh, wow.
I cried because as I was driving home to get my stuff to go to the airport, I saw someone who had just been hit by a car. One of these sellers.
The
hawkers on the street.
Yes.
They had just been hit by a car, and people were trying to get them to move. And I could see from the posture that she had broken her leg, or he had, I can't remember what gender the person was, at several places. And this is a hawker on the street. I know that they do not have any money to get help. And I was looking at what the injury was and realizing that injury was probably going to cause them to die in the next few days.
Oh.
And it was heartbreaking. And I miss that. I remember that was a lived experience,
yes.
Seeing people in all kinds of suffering and not feeling able to do anything because there's suffering around the world. There's suffering in Canada. But I feel like at least there's an opportunity to do something. So,
true.
Yeah, true. I miss a lot of things, but I miss them in different ways.
Mm. Mm. What's your favorite Nigerian food, and do you still eat it?
Okay, don't go there. I am in Nigeria. I told my children, like, when they cross the threshold into the house, they're in green, white, green. They're in Nigeria.
Right.
So I eat moi moi, amala, pounded yam. In fact, if I want to have pounded yam and an egusi soup this afternoon, it's going to happen. I have been blessed. My wife is a superstar. And, you know, I just have the good fortune of having a very strong Nigerian community that has created the capacity for our foods to be easily available. And people travel quite often,
yes.
I even have Oogie.
Ah.
I can have Oogie. No, trust me, there's little, you know, Nkwobi. You see, like, there is little that I want that is a Nigerian meal that I can't conjure up in 24 hours.
Ooh, wow.
So I don't miss any Nigerian food.
Mm. That's,
now, I miss the flavor.
Yes, it would be different. That's for sure.
Well,
not significantly, Abby.
Yeah, not significantly. Because even if I were going, I can roll up and get hooked up. Dundu,
in fact,
all those things, yes. Trust me, I'm not suffering.
You don't look like it's, don't worry, I know, I've seen the pictures, you don't look like it. I'm just putting mental notes in my head. So when you are in Canada and you just feel like eating Nigerian food, just go body up. So I'm quite like a couple of hours from you. Are you free? And it's not next week Saturday, it's now. And please make sure that you have prepared a table spread. Please, let just be sending your love to your wife for me so that we'll be okay. Oh, my word. Oh, my word. That is so cool. What do you do to unwind?
I try to run. I don't run as much as I want to, but I try to run. It's just something that I picked up recently and I'm enjoying. What do I do to unwind? So there's a bit of self-disclosure here. Hmm. I'm a card-carrying member of the Workaholics Anonymous.
Aha. Yes, when people start saying, what do I do to unwind? I kind of just figured that. Ben.
So, I don't know. I read.
You are a medicine, brother. It comes with the territory.
No, I read outside of medicine. I read a lot of books outside of medicine. I read leadership books. I read books. I run. I enjoy my liquor. I have occasionally. I have a glass of Grand Marnier,
okay.
And it's weird now because you're more likely to drink it by yourself now.
Yes, as opposed to with a group of friends.
Yeah.
True.
Yes. So, yeah. So I think, and I enjoy the company of my family.
And that's a very good
thing. Those are the things I think. Oh yes. They're good people. I'm keeping them.
Yeah, please do. We highly recommend it. Oh wow. So to your running, I mean, that's something I've been shifting that goalpost for myself for the last maybe 2 or 3 years. I can do a jog maybe every other kilometer, but definitely can't run straight out. And my goal is still to be able to run 10 keys nonstop. So I'm working on it. I do enjoy that because I don't think about anything, so really, and I'm not a deep thinker.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's really cool. All right, buddy. I'm going to have to let you go. This has been truly enlightening. You have not only opened the world of pediatric psychiatry to us, you've also opened the world of the parents to us. And the thing that I'm going to walk away with most ringing in my head, aside from your running 10 keys, is that we should be kinder to ourselves. And I think that's truly important. And once we can achieve that, we can look at everybody else with the eyes of love. And anything is not insurmountable. We can surmount anything once we look through the eyes of love. Dr. Bodi Akintan, thank you so much for spending the last hour, just over an hour, with us. I shall leave you to your cranberry juice and the rest of your Saturday and your nice long weekend. I hope you get the chance to put down your card of the Workaholics Anonymous for a little bit over the sister and spend some truly amazing time with your family over the weekend. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
You're welcome. Have a great day. Okay, so in fact, I think I'm going to find a name for these interviews. I think I'm going to rename them masterclasses or something. Because sometimes we go away with so much, not sometimes, all the time, we go away with so much information that has been passed on and in a relatable way. So that was our guest for this Saturday, Dr. Bodi Akintan, a pediatric psychiatrist based in Canada. And I'm personally going to listen to this all over again. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Spirit of Nigeria Radio, Weekend Nigeria, Positive Nigeria, and Energy, bringing Nigerians and diaspora up to speed.
Spirit of Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed.